Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin and maybe Florida wildlife as well with our guest, Scott Craven, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. So as we visit with him, I hope you'll join in. What wildlife questions do you have? Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry and listeners. It's great to be back.
Let's talk turtles to begin here. The number of calls about turtles on the roads, and maybe you could talk about why we see so many at this time of the year.
Well, it's a pretty straightforward explanation, Larry. It's the nesting season, and the turtles were out in the spring getting ready, and as soon as it's warm enough, usually mid-May to mid-June, the turtles are out and about, particularly the females, moving from whatever body of water or other place they've spent the winter and looking for nest sites. And they're pretty faithful to those nest locations, and some female turtles might move as far as several miles from wherever they've been living to find a suitable nest site, usually a sandy cut bank along the road, somebody's driveway, somebody's newly tilled flower bed, sites where they can easily dig a nest, deposit their eggs, cover them, and leave them. And the eggs simply sit there and experience environmental incubation, in other words, the warmth of the sun and summer weather. And those little turtles usually hatch by late summer. They may not emerge from the nest right away. In fact, in some cases, they may overwinter in the nest and then emerge the subsequent spring. But nevertheless, that's the system. And the turtles are out now wandering across the country looking for nesting sites. And so when you consider the speed at which a turtle travels, which isn't great, you can't cross too many busy highways before you've got some serious problems. So this is the time of year when the turtles need our help in two ways. Number one, helping them get to their destination, which is their nesting site, and to return safely. And that means watching out for turtle crossing signs, maybe being a little extra special observant when you're passing wetlands or suitable habitat for turtles. And if you can, and traffic allows it, and you're willing to do it, helping a turtle get across the road is an admirable thing to do. But don't risk your health and safety or the health and safety of other motorists to do that. And always be sure to put the turtle on the side of the road where it's headed, not where it came from, because it'll just come right back across the road. So be careful doing that, but do what you can to help them make it to the nesting sites. Once they're there, the nests are usually dug fairly quickly. The turtles are very single-minded about that activity, so you can try not to disturb them, but you can usually watch them pretty closely and take pictures while the turtles are laying their eggs. Once the nest is covered, especially after maybe there's been a little wind or rain, you'd be hard-pressed to ever know it was there. But if you see it being created, in other words, you see the eggs being laid, you can then mark that nest with a little twig or stake, and if it's an area where you can do it, it really helps to build a protective cage over it. You know, a chicken wire dome that's staked down tight to the ground will prevent the nest from being depredated by skunks, possums, raccoons, even coyotes, or in some cases, I swear, around my cabin in Price County last year, I probably had 40 or 50 painted turtle nests near the garage where they come out of a wetland next to the cabin, and virtually all were dug up and destroyed. And I actually watched a gray squirrel with an inordinate amount of interest in those nest sites, and I didn't see any foul play on the part of the squirrel, but I was a little suspicious. Anyway, a protective dome will really help the turtles avoid predators, and the little turtles can go right through the mesh and be on their way to the water when they do emerge. So that's the turtle situation in a turtle shell, so to speak.
Somebody was wondering how to pick one up. What's the safest way to pick up a turtle?
It depends a little bit on the turtle. Some are rather mild-mannered, but since they're out and about and, as I said, very single-minded, they have sharp claws. You can avoid those by picking up the turtle. Stay away from the business end, the head. Pin it down if you can with a if you're going to move it, pin it down with a stick or your shoe or whatever, and then grasp it firmly by the middle of the shell so that you're holding it from the top if your hand can span the shell, and then their flailing legs with those sharp claws can't get at you, nor can they bend their head far enough over their shell to get at you either. But if you're not careful and get too close to the business end, their jaws, their head and neck can extend further than would seem obvious, and they're very quick, and their jaws are very powerful and have a sharp edge. No teeth to worry about, but that sharp edge can do some damage, especially with a big snapping turtle. Now, with those, since they're big and heavy, grasping them is a little more problematic. Be sure they're pinned down because they'll often spin around and rotate to face what they perceive as a threat and be able to strike, and they can strike very quickly. If you can get them pinned down or immobile so you can get them by the tail, their tail is strong enough with a snapping turtle, so you pick them up by the tail and avoid the head and the claws. But don't let the turtle hang down next to your leg, or you're going to have some problems there too. So hold it away from you. You be careful. I'm sure that's not a pleasant experience for the turtle. And get it out of harm's way as quickly as you can and let it go about its business.
All right. Scott Craven, our guest today. You can join in, too. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Dane wondered if Wisconsin turtles return to their nesting areas like sea turtles do.
Apparently, they're pretty faithful to an area where they've been successful in finding suitable nesting substrate in the past. So the short answer is yes, but I'm sure a turtle going through its first nesting cycle is just looking for a suitable environment and isn't returning anywhere because it has no track record other than the nest that it emerged from. So there's a little variation there, but yes, if you've got a spot that turtles like, expect them back year after year. And as a matter of fact, since you mentioned the trip I just returned here from Florida over the weekend, it was pretty interesting seeing the sea turtle nests on some of the beaches around Venice and Boca Grande where we were fishing. The nests are all identified by volunteers when the big turtles come ashore at night, and then the nests are staked out with wooden stakes and flagging, brightly colored flagging tape. And on the stakes is written the day of initiation and the species of turtle and all other pertinent information. And people down there know that despite the fact that the beach had a lot of these marked nests on it, they give them a wide berth and stay away from them. And hopefully the turtles have a chance to hatch and get back in the ocean. So that was pretty cool, too, to see a parallel in Florida, but with those great big sea turtles.
And it was, you mentioned hatching. What's the gestation period?
Well, technically, I guess we can't call it gestation period because they're only incubated by environmental conditions. So it depends a little bit on how the summer progresses. If it's a nice, warm, sunny summer, which is certainly what this one is shaping up to be, then most of our local turtles would be emerging from the eggs in the nest late summer into maybe early September, about 3 months.
Scott Craven, our guest. Let's take some calls. Andy in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi. We started feeding hummingbirds this year, and the other day I noticed one of the males got hit by a car and, you know, didn't make it. And I was wondering, do they participate in raising the young or no?
Well, I think that they help bring some food to the young, but I suspect that the female, with a little extra effort, is probably capable of success if they've got young in the nest. That's unfortunate. How did you happen to I mean, they're so small and nondescript. How did you witness that, or find the dead bird, or what happened?
Yeah, it was right at the end of the driveway, so we were going for a bike ride, and I happened to look down, and there the little guy was, unfortunately.
Well, that's unfortunate, but we'll hope for the best as far as the brood is concerned, if they had a brood going. I've been keeping a close eye on a couple that we've got around the house. Mine, the male, has a favorite perch on my pole bean supports in the garden, and he's there constantly keeping an eye on his domain. So anyway, I hope yours do okay.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Paul in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hello. First, I had a comment on saving turtles, especially the big old ones. I was driving with some friends. Actually, they were driving. I was sitting in the back, and there was a big snapper crossing the road, probably a foot and a half in diameter, or, you know, front to back. Anyway, I picked it up so we could get it across the road so it wouldn't get hit. And I got back in the car, and my hands stunk so bad that I had to clench them very tightly, or they probably would have thrown me out of the car and go find a gas station to wash my hands. So they can be quite smelly, and I would imagine all of the older ones can be like that. But my real question was, early this year, I don't know if it was April, late April, early March, but early, it was still warm, and my wife and I saw several very small turtles. They had to have been newly hatched, and I know that's too early for egg-laying this year. I wonder, can they overwinter and then hatch in the spring?
Yes, they likely hatched last fall, but if the conditions are dry, the soil is baked hard, it's difficult for them to emerge, or they're late, somehow the little turtles sense that and will, as I mentioned, overwinter in the nest. And then with spring rains and good soil conditions, then they'll dig out and make their way to water. So most of the little, nickel or quarter-sized turtles that people see in the spring are actually last year's nesting, as you surmised.
Thank you, Paul. And Russ in Stoughton, your turn. Hi, Russ.
Good morning. I've had several experiences with trying to help turtles across the road. Number one comment is it's dangerous because if you got traffic behind you, they have no idea why you are stopping and getting out of your car, and there's horn honking and name calling, and they have no idea what you're doing. Number two is when you pick up mostly the most common turtle would be the painted turtle. Their defense is they pee on you. So you have to realize that that's going to happen. And the other thing is, the last comment is, with mud turtles, they have long enough necks that if you don't pick them up further beyond their head, they can reach back and actually bite you.
Well, All helpful suggestions, Russ. As Paul mentioned with the snapping turtle, he removed it. Didn't smell very good. And the fact is, when you pick up turtles, as you noted, they may urinate, defecate, or whatever. They're obviously probably upset about the situation. That may not smell so good. So you need to be ready for that, as you pointed out. And watch out, as I said, watch out for that head. Assume they can reach further than you think. And if they start striking and getting close to you, then put the turtle down fast and let it go about its business. As far as the traffic's concerned, I mean, that's a common sense thing. Yes, I know people would like to save turtles, but if there's heavy traffic, there's really not a great deal you can do without endangering yourself or someone else. So keep on going and hope the turtle makes it. It's not worth the risk.
Scott Craven, our guest today on the show, talking the world of wildlife. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking the World of Wildlife today with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. You know, I wanted to tell you, we got a couple of wildlife-related items on our show's blog that I think you're going to be interested in. I have two new posts up. One is all about Wisconsin amphibians and how to identify them out in the wild. So that's a good one. And there's another good one. It's an article spotlighting women in fly fishing. To find those articles, just go to WPR.org/Larry. You're going to see a link on the right-hand side of the page to the blog. So a couple of good stories there, and I hope you check them out. And let's check out Linda from Plymouth, who has a question for you, Scott, or a comment. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning. Early spring, I had a pileated woodpecker that I spotted in our woods behind our house, and then it was in my yard, and I would listen to it every day, and for the past week, I haven't heard it at all. So does a pileated woodpecker just come in and then move through like it's migrating?
Not necessarily, but you have to realize that they're a big bird. They have a substantial range or home range involving probably hundreds of acres. So the fact that it may have found something in your yard that was attractive, whether it was, they sometimes visit feeders, although not commonly, but there may have been a tree nearby that was on its last legs and was a good source of food for a while. Then the nesting season progressed and it's off taking care of business there or found a better food source. But it's probably still in the area. I wouldn't be, the fact that you're not here, plus it's been incredibly hot. Animals have been a little more secretive than normal and they're having trouble with the heat just like we are and the dryness, which has been brutal as well. So the fact that the bird has vanished for a week or two does not necessarily mean that it's gone or that some misfortune befell it and you're never going to see it again. I'd be patient, and chances are you'll hear and see the bird again.
Good luck, Linda. Thank you so much. Gianni in Marquette County, your turn now. Hi.
Yeah, hey, great show, Scott and Larry. Hey, listen, I regularly pick up turtles on the road. I live in a rural area, so traffic isn't a problem, but for $20, I got a pair of Kevlar gloves that I use to pick up turtles. And, you know, I picked up a couple snapping turtles with them, and, they can do a little damage. But with the gloves on and handling them correctly, it's not a problem. But my question concerns hummingbirds. How long should I leave my hummingbird feeder out in the fall? I have varying answers to this question, so I'm confounded. How long should I feed my hummingbirds?
Well, that's a very common question. It usually comes up in the fall of the year when people are either gearing up for winter bird feeding or winding down from whatever they were doing in the summer. I manage my feeder by just keeping an eye on the hummingbird and the weather. When we've had a frost, flowers have pretty well disappeared and been nipped back by the frost, the hummingbirds are going to move on. So at that point, there's the common concern is, well, if I leave the feeder up, the little guys are going to stay here too long and they're not going to make it out of town. I don't think that that's a major concern. Generally speaking, I think we all need to have a bit of faith in the evolutionary processes that have shaped these birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, and so forth. And generally, they're programmed to take care of themselves. When the food supply has diminished and it's time to move on, the birds will move on, whether the feeder's there or not. So it's a little bit of a fine-tuning art, but when the other birds start to disappear, the flowers are back, nipped back by frost, then I think you can take the feeder down and the hummingbirds will move off on their own. Okay? So that's,
Gianni,
I can't give you a specific date, but because it varies from fall to fall, but
yeah,
you and the hummingbirds will both know when it's time.
Okay, thanks, Gianni. John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you. Speaking of evolution, you brought up sea turtles. I heard that they kind of made it through the extinction that killed the dinosaurs because of the way that they nest and, I think, bury their eggs. How do sea turtles nest? And, like, how long does it take from laying to hatching? At least
It's really a fun process to see. I observed it in the Caribbean. And Scott, and you, I may have observed it as well.
Well, they nest essentially and bury their eggs just the way a painted turtle does around your hostas in the backyard. But the difference, of course, is the environment they're coming from. The sea turtles are off at sea, potentially covering lots of distance in the course of their life in the open ocean. But when it's time to nest, they, like our turtles, are faithful to their nesting beaches. And as I indicated, just coming back from Florida, both the turtles and the people involved who live there know what beaches are heavily used and by what species of sea turtles. And there's a strong protective sense in Florida residents, particularly along the beaches, and lots of volunteers to keep an eye on those turtles when they come ashore. They're coming ashore now, and as I indicated, the nests had already been laid and marked out so people could stay away from them. They usually come ashore at night under cover of darkness, move as quickly as a ponderous sea turtle can crawl through the sand up above the tide line, dig a nest, deposit their eggs, and then cover the nest with their flippers, and then return to the sea. And that's the extent of their involvement with nesting. The turtle eggs are incubated by the warmth of the sun, just as our turtles are here. And then when they emerge, it's for them, for the little turtles, it's get to the surf as fast as you can, or you're in big trouble from depredating birds and assorted other things that will pick them up rather quickly. That doesn't mean they don't have threats in the water as well, but nevertheless, it's a matter of dig out of the nest and make a beeline for that water as quickly as they can. And I assume, I don't know what the environmental incubation period is for those sea turtles, but I would assume it's pretty similar to ours. And by late summer, those turtles are emerging so they can get off on their own before the seasons change. So it's they're just bigger turtles in a very different environment, but the whole process is virtually identical to what our turtles are going through here.
I watched that happen on the island of Tobago, staying at a resort there, and in the evening and watching. I mean, the turtles didn't pay any attention. We had flashlights and actually watched even the eggs dropping into the hole. It's quite a sight to see, for sure. John, thanks again. Appreciate it. Virginia in New London, it's your turn.
Good morning, and thank you. My question is regarding the turtles. If I should come upon one on the road that has been run over and the shell is cracked or crushed, is there any way to save that turtle?
Yes. It's not uncommon to find them where they've been hit and the shell is cracked, but the turtle is still alive. And that is a situation analogous to finding any injured wildlife. Find an experienced, licensed wildlife rehabilitator. You can usually find them by checking on the DNR website, calling a DNR office, calling a local nature center. And you know, in the meantime, keep the turtle as immobile and quiet as you can and work quickly because you don't have a lot of time depending on the extent of the injury. But it is possible for rehabbers, again, depending on the nature of the injury, to essentially, well, I guess I'd say glue them back together, but essentially repair the shell so that the turtle has a chance at survival. I don't know what the odds are, depends on the injury, but if they're still alive, it's worth a try, and there are people who know how to do it.
Good luck. Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate it. Vicki in Lake Mills emailed to ask you, how do you keep rabbits from eating flowers and shrubs, and how do you discourage grackles from eating at the bird feeders?
Well, there's a couple of questions we've never heard before, Larry. Well, let's take the rabbit situation first, because it's a daily struggle for me right now. I, as you know, Larry, I live out in the countryside south of Madison, but I have lots of gardens, berry patches, and a small orchard, a variety of things, and the rabbits are right now are the bane of my existence. Early on in the garden season, when things are first coming up and the things like beans and peas are fairly small, the rabbits have the capacity to cause a considerable amount of loss in a short period of time. Whereas later in the season, when the plants are mature, I tend to ease up a little bit on the rabbit situation, because there's more produce in the garden than either my family, neighbors, friends, and all the rabbits in southern Dane County could eat. So it depends a little bit on the season. But rabbits do have the capacity to not only damage gardens, flower beds, landscape plants, and so on. So a little bit of protection is a good thing. For the most part, I rely on fencing. If I really have to protect something, then small mesh fence is the only essentially foolproof, and it's not foolproof, technique that I know of. And there are fencing products that are designed to deal with rabbits. There was one called Rabbit Guard a few years ago, usually a couple feet high with small spacing at the bottom that got increasingly large as it went up. Even chicken wire, large mesh chicken wire, will not prevent a small nestling rabbit from going through it like it wasn't even there. So you need to be a little careful with your fencing to make sure it's rabbit-proof. But fencing's the surefire thing. Removal of the rabbits is probably next in line. They're not that difficult to catch in a good live trap, baited with fresh vegetables, sliced apple, carrot, things like that. With the trap best placed along a travel corridor that you know the rabbits use, a hole in the fence, a gap in the fence, an area where the yard adjoins some cover the rabbits are using. And then you can, once they're captured, you can move them to somewhere where you have permission to let them go. Repellents will help in some cases. There are many things on the market, some based on hot sauce, some based on fungicides like Thyram, some products like dried blood meal, and other things. You know, go to your garden center and see what they're recommending currently, and they may provide short-term protection. When my seedlings are coming up and I really need to protect something, I usually sprinkle some moth flakes, naphthalene flakes, around the row, just to kind of get them past the vulnerable stage with the rabbits. And so there are a few things like that help on the repellent situation, but repellents are not foolproof, and if it's raining a lot, they can be washed away. The fencing will work. The rabbits can be removed by trapping. And, of course, in the countryside, some people will remove the rabbits with gunfire where it's safe and legal to do so. And that has to be something that fits into your personal preference as to whether you want the rabbits removed dead or alive. So those are a few of the tactics, and it requires constant vigilance, because the rabbits didn't get the reputation of breeding like rabbits without some merit. They'll have multiple litters per year, and 4, 5, 6 little bunnies per litter. So their reproductive potential can keep ahead of some of your control strategies if you're not very diligent. That's kind of the situation on the rabbit front. As far as the grackles are concerned, that's a tougher one. Generally, they're more prone to bother solid feeders like shelf feeders or wooden feeders that are stable, rather than getting on to rather shaky suspended feeders. You might be able to change up your strategy a little bit there, scare them when you get the chance. But if you're in an area where they're nesting in, say, a row of large evergreens on the in a park nearby or on the neighbor's property, you just have to grin and bear it for a few weeks. And the grackles aren't as persistent or as long-term over the course of the summer as red-winged blackbirds and some other birds that people consider less than desirable. So that's a tough one.
Yeah, yeah, it is indeed. Rich in Merrill, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Rich.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Scott. I have a short story before my question. Two summers ago, let's say early May, I was canoeing around a floating bog with a group of fifth graders, and we spotted six, maybe eight, dead and dismantled mature snapping turtles. Question, is that something otters would do? Will they kill and consume a snapping turtle?
That's a dandy question, and I don't know the answer for sure. I suppose it's possible if there's a predator out there that's capable of doing that. An otter is probably the likely candidate, but so they were all in one place. There are half a dozen turtles there, dismembered.
No, not in one spot. They were pretty much spread out all the way around the floating bog.
Okay, and not in a place where these were anything that were trapped and harvested for human consumption with the remains left behind. That wasn't a possibility.
No, and it wouldn't be any trapping there. It's Girl Scout camp. We're allowed to eat during the spring for some of our science trips.
And these were good size. I think you said they were mature, so good size snapping turtles.
Yes, fully grown.
Well, let's consider the list of possible suspects here. It's a fairly short list. I don't think there's any member of the bird world capable of doing that. Those animals are too big and powerful. Nor is there any fellow reptile, and certainly not an amphibian, capable. So we're left with mammals, and among those, too big for a mink or some of the other aquatic species that would handle clams and fish and so forth, mink and muskrats and whatnot. So otter's the only possibility there. If the turtles were out along the edge of the bog, I suppose I'm giving more credit here to raccoons than they might deserve, but I guess a big old coon is a pretty powerful animal. That's a possibility as well, but I don't know. Depredation on an adult snapping turtle is not something I've heard much about over a lot of years of listening to these kinds of things. So is it possible that something else some other fate might have claimed the turtle and the dead turtles were scavenged? If that were the case, then there are probably other suspects. But in terms of killing them, it's a pretty short list.
Yeah, it is indeed. Rich, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Lyric in Blanchardville, thank you for calling.
Hi. Recently, a close neighbor of mine, and I'm very happy with my baby prairie plants from Westfield Nursery, and I'm out there in my yard. My neighbors put up a bug zapper that sometimes runs very long times, meaning even overnight when they're not outside. So my question is this. I got on the internet and started doing research about bug zappers, and several universities have done really good studies, scientific studies, on 1 to 5% of the bugs zapped are actually bad bugs, what they would call bad bug, and the rest is pollinators. So I have a two-part question. One is there, because of the universities, even I think it was the University out of Florida had a lot, Colorado, Texas Children's and Infants, all said more harm than good. Is there any information available where you could hand it to a neighbor that is civil and lining out why we might all die if we don't have food, if we don't have pollinators? And I'm aware that the monarchs are 99% gone and California, how do we keep our pollinators alive in a world where perfect lawn seemed to be the sign of an intelligent person?
Well, that's a very thoughtful observation and a very complicated question. As to the bug zappers first, I'm aware of the kind of research you were referring to and the fact that a lot of beneficial insects are also taken out by bug zappers, and that although it seems satisfying sitting in your backyard to hear the zapping going on and say, there's one less mosquito that's going to get me, it's my impression that the facts differ from the perception in terms of a bug zapper providing a bug-free yard. But that question in terms of how to approach the neighbor or a community, neighborhood, or what have you, is probably better posed to an entomologist. Larry, do you have somebody on kind of taking Phil's place now?
Well, P.J. Leash, Phil actually comes on every few months. P.J. Leash from the Insect Diagnostic right. Lab.
Well, either Phil or P.J. when they're on, you know, that would be a good thing to let them expound on for a couple minutes, because I'm sensitive to what the caller's concerned about here. But this is kind of analogous to other bits of technology that have worked their way into people's minds because of very difficult problems to solve otherwise, like keeping a bug-free yard. The other one that comes to mind was the big dust-up years ago over these deer whistles that people were installing by the thousands with the hope that that would prevent deer vehicle collisions. And other electronic or fancy gadgets to drive away mice or protect against bats. And I don't think any of these things have really been as effective as advertising might suggest. But again, this is something I think the entomologist could speak to. In terms of protecting pollinators in general and providing habitat for pollinators, that's something that seems to have really come into its own in recent years. I see lots more articles in everything from DNR publications to the various conservation organizations around the country promoting the need to protect pollinators and to plant things in the yard, garden, a corner that doesn't need to be mowed anymore, anything like that to attempt to help pollinators. And of course, monarch butterflies have gotten a lot of the press lately, but I pulled out an article the other day. Oh, here we go. Here's a release that I printed in anticipation of the program that talks about increasing pollinator habitat. And it was in the context of monarch butterflies, but it says there are a lot of great resources specific to Wisconsin on how to add milkweed and other habitat for pollinators. Here are a few to check out. The DNR apparently has a Saving Native Pollinators webpage, or there's information on their webpage. The Wisconsin Monarch Collaboratives Create Habitat webpages. And Wisconsin Women in Conservation, well, this webinar is passed, but I suspect they probably have a website, but they had an Increasing Pollinator Habitat webinar back last month. So there are lots of things going on. So I think we can take heart that things are getting better on that front, and acting as individuals can do anything or everything that we want to or can to provide pollinator habitat around our homes.
Lyric, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today, as we talk the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. So great to have him with us to talk wildlife. Our lines are all filled and lots of emails, so let's go back Well, let's go back to those emails for just a minute here. John in Port Wing emailed, he's quite certain he spotted an elk north east of Saxon, Wisconsin. He's familiar with elk, and although it was about 200 yards away, he's quite sure that's what it was. Is that possible? The location would be 30 miles from the release area near Clam Lake.
Well, yes. We learned a long time ago dealing with wildlife, Larry, that you never say never to anything. And 30 miles is certainly within the range of, did he say it was a bull? Is that what I heard?
He just said, he didn't say bull, he just said elk, but he was sure it was an elk and not a whitetail.
They can certainly cover that kind of distance, and you know, the DNR keeps a pretty close tab on those animals. They're in the midst of wrangling over the new elk management plan, and the elk tags for this fall's harvest season were just released. So there's a lot of interest and talk about elk right now. I think that calling the DNR office and the biologist who handles the elk in that northern herd, as they're now calling it, around Clam Lake would like to hear about that sighting, because they keep pretty close tabs on them. So I think that should go to the DNR people in charge, and they may, because they do keep close tabs, that was an elk from such and such an area, and we're kind of keeping an eye on him or her. So I think that John could get more information on that from the DNR.
Todd in Tomahawk has a question for you. Todd, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Hey, I have a hummingbird feeder on each side of my home. And a few weeks ago, I was walking into the living room, and at one of the feeders, I caught a glance of an oriole of some sort or another. It flew away. That same day, I went and purchased an oriole feeder. I took down the hummingbird feeder that was there and moved it over to the other side of the house where the other one was. I put up the oriole feeder. I additionally added a couple of slices of oranges with grape jelly on two of the four perches, and I left it up for a week and a half and never saw that oriole again. So I was kind of wondering, we're like 40 miles north of Wausau. I was curious if they continue to migrate north, or if I know that they can nest in our area too, but I was just kind of wondering about my timing, if I was too late, or what, if you have any advice on attracting and keeping orioles of any sort.
Well, Larry and I are both avid oriole feeders and go through an awful lot of grape jelly. So my strategy is to have the feeder, just like you describe, with a receptacle to hold the jelly and a couple of orange halves to attract them, because they like those too, and they're very visible. Have that ready to go. And we usually, my wife and I, keep a pretty close eye on the backyard. And as soon as that first oriole is either spotted or it's anticipated, as you know, birds are moving through, usually by late April, early May, then up goes the feeder. And there are a few other birds. My catbirds seem to go after the jelly. So do some of the house finches. So it doesn't have any, doesn't hurt anything to keep it up, get it up a little early. But the orioles use it, both the ones that nest around here and as they're moving through. But eventually, that activity just kind of fizzles out. And we were talking last night about, there's no jelly in the jelly feeder. But by the same token, the orioles had stopped visiting it. And then one did show up. A female showed up last night looking for jelly. So we put a little more out. But it's getting to the point where the jelly feeder is no longer necessary. But it's certainly a nice addition to a bird feeding station. And I urge you to put it up every spring and be patient. You'll get orioles either as they're passing through, or eventually get one that's going to settle down there. As far as the hummingbird feeders, though, I would keep them up, rather than putting them together. I like the idea of having them on opposite ends of the house, because, as you know, the male hummingbirds hassle each other with great vigor, and having the feeders spaced out a little bit will give more birds a chance at the nectar rather than having them in one place where they'll squabble with each other. So,
yeah,
Larry, you have anything to add on the jelly situation? Are you still getting Orioles?
No, that's gone by the board for.
Yep. So that's probably a done deal for this year.
Thank you, Todd. Paul in Draper, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Good morning, Scott. I was unfortunate to get a turkey's tag this spring. A friend of mine had a tag for the last season up here in six. So I went out with him to call, and we called in a wolf the one day, and we called in another wolf hunting in the same area, but it was a different wolf on the second day. Then on Saturday, the last weekend of that season, we called in another wolf, and he ran off with my Dave Smith decoy.
Oh!
So, Sorry, I don't mean to laugh. That's a pretty good story, though. Go ahead, continue, please.
Well, you know, I didn't have a gun, so I knew what I would have done. But we don't have hardly any deer up here in Surrey County, and when you're calling in wolves with a turkey call, I mean, they must be getting awful hungry because. And yeah, I haven't found the decoy yet. I was wondering if, you know, wolves kill the bear hunter's hounds. Will they reimburse me for my $150 decoy?
I was going to say that's an expensive decoy. I knew as soon as you said.
It can't hurt to file a claim. I think if nothing else, it'll cause a laugh at the office when it goes in. But I would guess that the wolf probably didn't take too long to figure out, wow, this is really a chewy turkey. I'm not getting anywhere here. So you may find the decoy yet, but that's really an interesting story. I've heard of people calling in. I've seen coyotes sneaking around when I'm calling or have the decoys out, and occasionally other things coming in out of curiosity. But apparently the wolves have figured out that turkeys are just another menu item, and they thought they were going to get an easy meal.
It's a great story, Paul.
That's really a great story. I thank you for calling, Paul. I know you lost a decoy, but those new turkey decoys can get pretty pricey, but that's a great story, and it happened. I guess you called in three animals. And by the way, Larry, the turkey harvest is tabulated at just over 35,000 now, so it was another successful turkey season, despite some various weather of various types. But still, the turkey harvest is staying right up there. So, anyway.
Yeah, good, Paul, and thank you again. I love that story. Let's go to Chris and Adams next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I have another funny one. I was living out at a campground, and all of a sudden, my cats started going crazy in the window. And I looked out, and there was a raccoon that had flipped over a very large snapper on its back. And it was just sitting there grabbing the eggs as they came out and having an omelet.
Wow. Well, that's another good one. Boy, Larry, we're plowing some new ground here today. So the coon must have come upon the snapper as it was nesting, and wow, that's really cool. that would have made a great video if it could have been captured. But
thank you, Chris, for that story. Man, oh man, Lois in DeForest. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My story isn't quite as exciting as that, but on Sunday, I'm kind of a woodchuck watcher and advocate. And on Sunday morning, for an hour, an adult woodchuck is at her den, you know, the hole to the den, and she's calling, and it sounded like a bird, but it was a very long tweet. And I said, oh. And so I checked, and sure enough, it was a woodchuck calling. almost an hour. Okay, so then at the end of the day, late afternoon, three little woodchuck heads are at just their heads nursing. That was just, interesting to me. So,
well, thanks, Lois. That's something I've never observed either.
You mean the vocalization or the young woodchucks or both?
Both.
Yeah. Well, you know, they do communicate. And remember, their Western relatives, the marmots, they're essentially a marmot. Sometimes one of the common names for them is whistle pig because of their sharp call. And I think, you know, other fossorial or digging mammals are often pretty vocal. Even chipmunks have a peculiar bird-like call note that I think many people mistake for a bird. So
yeah, pretty
anyway,
cool.
Anyway, that's the situation there. They do communicate with each other. So.
Scott Craven, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Scott. I'm Larry Mueller. Here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking wildlife with our regular guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. So, questions about wildlife on your mind or maybe an experience to share? We've heard some good ones during the show. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Kathleen in Fifield, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Kathleen.
Oh, hello, you guys. It's so good to talk to you. And, Scott, I've always wanted to call and talk to you, but I just never did before. I had an ermine this winter. I've had one around almost every winter that I can remember. And this one was living under my mobile home and also an outshed that I have. And he's been seen by neighbors dragging in a rabbit, you know, he's backing up and pulling it all the way. But now, just before the heat wave, I was standing outside in my garden, and this weasel came by. I mean, it's part ermine and weasel yet then. And he came, I stood real still, and he came up and sniffed my boots. And wasn't too sure, but he decided to take a chance. He went under the mobile, under the house, and he brought out a baby. So it's not a he, I had to say, while I was standing there. I had named him Herman, but Hermione might be better now. But anyway, she did that three or four times. I lost count. I was so excited just standing there and watching this. She'd come out with the first one, and then she'd disappear into the flowers that were growing. And then she'd come out without it, and she went under the house, brought another one. She did that three times for sure. I don't even remember if there was a fourth. But the last time she did it, she had like what looked like a part of a rabbit that was fur on it, you know, and so that was part of the food. My question is, now I had also, I discovered the hole that she had gone down. It was right next to a rock. But it was hidden by the flowers growing. And I would put some raw suet, pieces of raw suet near the hole, and it would disappear in a matter of time. But as soon as the heat wave came, I stopped doing that because it's the suet that hasn't been cooked and all that
right.
Thing. So, yeah. So, in any case, then I did stop doing that. I thought, well, I know she's a pretty good hunter, so I'm not worried about it. I was just trying to help her out a little bit if she needed some fat. Well, now I'm wondering if they're even still there anymore. Do you think she would have moved them again? Or would they be up and about and out, but we've seen no sign of them?
Hmm.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's unusual to see a weasel anyway, regardless of what species of weasel it is. They're pretty quick. They're pretty secretive. And it's a cool sighting, whether you see it during the winter or as you have now while they're during the breeding season. So you're already ahead of the game. As far as whether they're still there or not, it's not uncommon for mammals to move the females to move their young from an existing nest to another site, whether it's because of perceived danger or threat, or it could have been the temperature change, or for whatever reason, or parasites got into the nest. There could be a lot of reasons why the female's relocating the young. So it could still be where you saw it go, or it could be off on one or two or three other sites. There's no way to ever know. So keep your eyes open, and you may eventually see the young out and about. One thing that may work if you go near the site or you're sitting there quietly, since the weasel was inquisitive, as they are anyway, when you said it approached your boot, is to kind of suck on the back of your hand and make a squeaking sound, kind of like that. And that with weasels often attracts them in thinking that the message to them is, whoa, there's a mouse or a baby rabbit or something in danger and squealing. I better check it out. It might be an easy meal. And you might get a look at them that way, too. Or you could also position a camera trap, a motion-sensitive camera, near where the den was or in a likely spot or near some food you put out and get some pictures that way. So there are a couple of opportunities to still make contact with them, but I'm sure they're around there somewhere.
Yep, I agree. Thank you, Catherine, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Lois in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi there. I have orioles every year, and they always disappear at this time, so I'm figuring they're nesting, because then they come back with their young ones, and then the young ones, when they can fly, they show them how to eat, they give them a little jelly, and pretty soon the young ones will hop down and figure out how to fly and get to the jelly, and it's just really cool, and I keep my feeders up until probably the end of summer, practically, so so I let you know.
Well, you're in Fifield, Kath. Kathleen, oh, I'm sorry, you're not in Fifield. You're in Chippewa Falls, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really fun watching. Really, that you see them put the jelly in their little baby's mouths, you know, and then they are so cute and they try to fly down to the feeder. So,
yeah. Well, it's a nice story.
Yeah, based on your experience, Lois, since the feeder is still sitting out there and not causing any problem, I think I'll keep it filled out and see who uses it and see if the orioles actually come back later in the nesting season. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Thank you.
Thank you very, yeah, thanks very much. Adam called to mention that the guy who lost the turkey decoy to the wolf should tell the company. They may give him a new one just for the good publicity.
Well, yeah, I mean, a wolf is a pretty wary animal. If the wolf was convinced it was a turkey, enough to pick it up and make off with it, it's a darn good turkey decoy. So that's a pretty good idea. They might like to use it in their advertising.
Exactly.
You might get a whole truckload of decoys.
Oh, boy. Travis emailed that swallows making nests in the peaks of his house are an issue. Can he make a nesting site for these birds?
Swallows, especially when they're making their mud nests on top of a downspout or somewhere where you don't want it, can be a little problematic. But you have to, birds are protected, so are their nests and eggs and so forth. So sometimes that's a bit problematic, but there are actually commercial kits available if there's a spot that's used year after year by the swallows in an eaves area, for example, or around the soffit. There are ways to screen that off with either the commercial kits or just by attaching a piece of plastic sheeting or screen, running it from the roof line or the gutter edge on an angle down to the wall, and then attaching it with little Velcro or duct tape or whatever. It may not look particularly attractive, but if it's put up at the right time and then taken down after the birds have moved on to nest elsewhere, then you can prevent the heartburn from having those nests where you don't want them.
But can you make a nest? I think Travis wants to know if he could make a nesting site for them other than...
Well, that's a bit tricky. They pick some bizarre sites to build those or plaster those mud nests, but it's possible that you might put up a nesting platform. They usually like to have some overhead cover, and they may use it, but the whole birdhouse thing is kind of a gamble. I mean, you put up a fancy bluebird house and they nest in a mailbox or a hollow post or something that you didn't anticipate. So it's worth a try, but I think most people are more concerned with keeping them away from a site that where they'd rather not have them and let them find another site on their own, especially on an outbuilding or some site where the nest isn't that much of a problem.
Bill in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guest. I have 16 acres just outside of town here, and I got all kinds of critters. And it was about a year ago, I found a turtle in my yard. It was about, I want to say, maybe 5-6 inches wide, maybe 6-8 inches tall or long, and it had a real dark kind of a helmet looking type shell. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the heck did it get here? I have no idea. If it did, it took them years. I don't know. I'm just curious if your guests would know what kind of turtle it was.
Could you describe the shell again?
Helmet shell.
Well, it looked like a helmet. You know, not like a painted turtle has kind of a flatter shell. This one was kind of big and like a German soldier helmet sort of.
Well, that's a
snapper. Dark color.
That's a description for the shell often used to describe box turtles, which can cover a lot of ground and are not the least bit interested in water. So that's one possibility. But there's another one, a Blanding's turtle, which has a very high dome shell that could be described as helmet-like, which also wanders widely on dry upland sites, again, not necessarily very near water. So I would look in a turtle guide at those two species, Blanding's and box turtle, and see if that rings a bell.
That's a good point. And, Jim emailed with the answer. He had an answer for why the turtles cross the road.
Yes.
to get to the Shell station.
Oh, geez. Yeah, things are deteriorating. Larry, if I have a moment, we've had a lot of people calling today who are very concerned about, doing things to help wildlife and, get through turtle nesting and bird nest selection and so forth. I'd just like to point out that it is so darn dry over a lot of Wisconsin right now. I'm finding, turkeys coming into my water garden where they normally wouldn't be desperate for a drink, and birds just fighting over the bird bath. If you've got a way to get some water out there on the landscape, it is, at least in a lot of southern Wisconsin, desperately dry right now. And, feeders and so forth are great, but right now water is a pretty strong attractant as well. And along that note, Larry, I was talking to you earlier this morning that the folks who are calling and are so interested in wildlife, I just wanted to put a plug out there that the next time I'm on in August, I'll be giving a little promo for a couple of trips that my friend Paul from Door County Nature Travel and I will be taking out this coming winter. And if folks are interested in getting out there and seeing some interesting wildlife, we'll be leading our annual tour to the Everglades again at the end of February, and will be leading the Yellowstone and winter trip again at the end of January and early February. And, you know, for wildlife viewing, it's pretty hard to beat Yellowstone National Park and Everglades National Park. And there'll be more details on those trips when I'm on in August. So if you think that might be something you'd like to sign on to, more details will be forthcoming. But get some water out there in the meantime. Everybody could use it.
Yeah, my bird bath is, I just refilled the water this morning, and they're out there having a good time.
Have you seen the pictures of Lake Mead, Larry?
No.
It's incredible. I mean, it's the West is drying out rather quickly. But anyway.
Well, we had a listener emailed. They routinely cycle by or bypass, go past three osprey nests near Lake Kiganza. They noticed some osprey earlier this year, but there hasn't been any activity over the last couple of weeks. Friends mentioned that another osprey nest in the area is not inhabited. Is there an issue with osprey this year?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, they move around a little bit. Whether they would move on to nest site, it may be related to prey availability. If the water levels are low or there's something going on with their normal fishing grounds, they might relocate, I suppose. But I've not heard of anything that would explain that a population decline such that the ospreys are not anywhere. I suspect these birds are just somewhere else for whatever reason.
Yeah. Alice in Campbellsport, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I have a turtle story for you.
Okay.
When my children were in grade school, at the end of the school year, they brought home a pet turtle in a bowl. And after a while, I didn't want it in the house. And we put it outside in the window well, basement window well, mm-hmm. with the metal around it. Mm-hmm. And it lived there for a couple months. And then we decided we walked to the nearest creek about three-quarter mile away and set it down, and it went right to the water and swam away.
Huh.
Okay, fast forward years, and I had moved away and the place was for sale, and I went out there to pick berries, and I decided to walk around the house. And I happened to look in the window well, and there was a dried-out skeleton of a turtle.
Wow.
It apparently fell in and starved and couldn't get out. It was, I would say it was maybe 8 inches across.
Oh.
And my question is, why? Why was it there? Was it the same turtle?
Well, I guess we'll never know the answer to that issue, but over the... over the years, I used to get lots of calls about window wells being something of a death trap for turtles, occasionally snakes, and other things that fell into them and couldn't get out. And often we'd recommend a little wooden, rough wooden ramp that animals that got trapped in a notorious window well could have a way of escape. I guess the story suggests that if we knew, holy cow, maybe that turtle was going back to where it lived in the window well. But a window well is not I don't know how the turtle survived for a couple months in the window well after you put it there in the first place. So I don't know what to make of that. It's an interesting story, whether the association is there or not. Don't know. And I don't know, one of the problems, of course, if a turtle came home from school as a pet, in days gone by, the common turtles sold in pet stores, or when I was a kid in hardware stores where they'd have a big tub full of turtles, were red-eared sliders, which are a southern species that hit the pet trade. And occasionally they would turn up in the wild because people were letting pet turtles go where they had not much chance of survival. So it's hard to tell what all pieces together there, but... interesting story on a lot of different fronts.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. A listener emailed to ask if it's common for a three adult fox to raise a litter together. They have what appears to be two males and a female burrowed under the deck with a litter. Or would it be a leftover staying home from last year? Curious as can be as to what's going on.
Well, we'll never know for sure, but occasionally animals will remain from a previous litter and hang out and actually assist the parent animals with another breeding cycle. So that's possible. In fact, the most likely explanation, although there may be others, is that that was an animal from last year's reproductive effort, and it's simply still hanging around and pitching in a little bit.
Huh. A listener emailed to ask when raccoons with babies leave their nests. She's in southern Wisconsin and can't plant any until they are gone because they eat them annually. I'm not sure about the wording on that, but let's go with how long would baby raccoons be with their mom?
Quite a while. I mean, they may travel together well into the summer. Usually in spring when I start having raccoon issues around my feeders, it's sometimes a family group, and it gets to the point where the young, even half grown, are still hanging out with the female. But I'm assuming that based on that question, the raccoon family may be somewhere where they're not wanted, like a chimney flue or something like that. And they're hoping that they'll clear out so they can get on with whatever they need to do, or cleaning out where they were nesting. And that can usually be encouraged, the departure, once the young can move on their own, can be encouraged with something odoriferous like naphthalene or moth flakes or some ammonia on a rag or whatever that would cause the animals to relocate out of a chimney. I guess I don't know exactly what the question is there, Larry.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. And Pete in Reedsburg said with snapping turtles, he gets a stick and holds it over next to the head, and the snapper clamps on, and then he just carries it across that way because the snapper won't let go.
Yep, I've seen that done and tried it myself, and you can drag them or pick them up and whatever works. A coal shovel, I usually carry a shovel in the back of the truck, and usually you can scoop them up on a coal shovel or something too and move them out of the way. I got badly bitten as a child by a snapping turtle that my dad had in a galvanized trash can. It was a big one, and I was curious and got a little too close, and the thing latched onto my index finger, and like the stick we were just talking about, it wouldn't let go, and I remember that as being a very unpleasant experience. So be careful around those snapping turtles, whether you use a stick, a shovel, or anything else. Be careful.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your visit in August. Thank you so much.
All right, take care, Larry, and listeners, have a good summer.
Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Be sure, again, to head over to our blog. Two new posts up, one about Wisconsin amphibians and how to identify them in the wild, and the other about that spotlights a woman in fly fishing. Just go to WPR.org/Larry, and you'll see a link on the right-hand side of the page to the blog. Thank you so much for listening. John Freiberger back to talk about rain screen systems on tomorrow's show. But in the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.